A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on July 10, 1994, in the Job series, entitled, What It Takes to Make a Heretic. The scripture reading is Job chapters 1 through 2. The text for the sermon is Job 6, verses 25 through 26. Please note that there is some audio interference in the last two lines of the sermon. In case you cannot understand them, they say, "That's a God you can love when everything goes wrong and nothing makes sense." Copyright Grand Valley State University.
I begin this morning a series of messages on the book of Job. It's the first time, well, I shouldn't say that, our Wednesday night meditations, I tried it a couple of years ago, but it's the first time I've ever tried to preach on Job in a serious fashion to handle the content of the writing itself, because I haven't understood it. Oh, a text here and there, a text torn out of context can make a whale of a sermon on occasion. But an insight into the composition of the book some time ago enabled me to crack open the enigma of the book of Job. The book of Job is a part of the wisdom literature of the Hebrew Scriptures. Job, Ecclesiastes, Proverbs, some of the Psalms. The wisdom literature is a particular genre of the Hebrew Scriptures and has its own characteristic themes. And we don't do a lot with it in the church, actually, and I haven't done a lot with it in preaching. But as I said, the book of Job has been for me an enigma, but I find that in understanding something of the composition of the book, that it becomes a marvelous and powerful message which deals with the very concrete stuff which makes up our human experience. And so I want to begin this morning in a kind of introductory fashion to deal with this book and suggest to you that you might like to be reading it in the course of these weeks. We'll see how far the series goes, 4, 5, 6, who can tell, once a preacher gets started. But I want to deal with the book of Job because I think that it deals with the things that we wrestle with every day in our lives, the unvarnished stuff of human life. And the enigma to me that has kept me from ever treating it as a whole has a couple of aspects. In the first place, Job has become, in popular understanding, the patient Job. And we come by that honestly because in James 5:11 we are told, you know the patience of Job. And so in conventional wisdom, Job becomes the model of patience. And to be sure, in what I read, the prologue to the book, he certainly is patient. But when you read the whole central section of the book, Job is not patient. He is one of the most impatient people in the Bible. He rails against heaven. He calls God to account. He damns the day he was born. Job is no kind of submission, patient endurance, but a rebel with a cause. And I could never put those two things together. And then, if you read not only the prologue that I read a moment ago, but the epilogue, the last few verses of the last chapter, you'll find that after this terrible suffering, total loss, and his experience of God in the whirlwind, Job gets everything back twofold. And so, it would appear that to suffer, to be patient, is finally to be vindicated and rewarded. And that also contradicts the whole powerful, passionate center of this poem. It's like the poems cry out to heaven in protest, and then suddenly something tacked on the end that says, but it all became nice and they lived happily ever after. Well, the insight that helped me to make some sense of this book is that it probably, in its prologue and epilogue, is an ancient legend, probably centuries and generations old, that the author of the present poems, as we have it, took to himself as a means by which to make his point, so that we have his poems with their violent protest, as it were, sandwiched between a prologue and an epilogue that are reflective of another age and a totally other philosophy and understanding. Now you say, well, what's the sense of that? And incidentally, if you read the first couple of chapters and then read those last few verses, you'll see that they are of a consistent mind, which is absolutely contrary to the whole center. But why would the poet who wanted to make the point of those poems in the center, why would he sandwich that between this ancient legend? Well, maybe some have said because he wanted to set his own point of view in sharp contrast to the other. The ancient legend says that God blesses those who are good and God punishes those who are evil. The ancient legend says if you suffer and endure patiently, you will be rewarded. The poet says, I don't believe it. It is contrary to everything that I experience and observe in human life, and I don't believe it. Maybe by setting that ancient legend at either side of his protest, he sets it off all the more starkly. Or maybe he softened the edges of his protest by encasing it in this ancient legend just in order to get it published. You know, it's dangerous to swim against the tide. It's dangerous to speak a word against conventional wisdom. It can cost you your life to hold an opinion contrary to that which everybody knows. Do you know how much we live by what everybody knows? Well, everybody knows that. Well, everybody knows that. Well, obviously, there's no question about it. Everybody knows that. Oh, really? The poet says, I don't know that. I don't believe that. No, 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 no. But you better be careful when you say no, when everybody else is saying yes. It would be interesting if you want to do a doctoral dissertation, trace through history the significant written works that were published after the author's death. Published after the author's death purposely, because if they had been published in his life, he would have lost his life. He would have died sooner than he really did. Job, you see, was a heretic. Job, the poet of Job, was a heretic. He spoke a word against what everybody knows and what nobody thinks about, but everybody believes. He was not orthodox. He was heretical. Now, the word orthodox means straight opinion. The prefix ortho is from the Greek language. When I was a kid, I used to be able to spit through my teeth. And then my mother sent me to an orthodontist. Orthodontist made my teeth straight. Because my father had me set apart for the ministry. Otherwise, I don't think they'd have straightened my teeth. And if you break your leg and it's at right angles, you'll go to an orthopedic surgeon. He makes bones straight. And if you are orthodox in theology, you hold the right opinion. You hold the straight, accepted, received view of things. This poet was not orthodox. This poet was a heretic. Heretic also comes from the Greek language. It means to choose. To choose. William Sapphire, the New York Times columnist, has a relatively recent book on Job. He calls it the first dissident. Job was the first dissident. Comes from the Latin, dissent, to sit apart. And a dissident is one who sits apart, stands apart, and acts apart. I don't use the word dissident because I'm not thinking as Sapphire is largely of the political and economic realm, but I'm thinking more theologically. And theologically, this poet is a heretic. He ran contrary to the commonly accepted view of things in his day. He stood up and dared to say no. He stood up, dared to be alone, have the passion and conviction that enabled him with courage to say, I don't believe it. He was a heretic. What makes a heretic? Concrete human experience that can't be crammed into conventional wisdom as an explanation. Burning, passionate, concrete experience that you just can't shove into a ready-made pigeonhole. A heretic is one whose experience brings him to the point where he dares to stand up and to say, no, I don't believe it. This is what I believe. Job, the poet, was a heretic. Because in his day, everybody knew that suffering was a sign of sin. That the one who was suffering was carrying some guilt, whether known or unknown. In his day, the poet ran into the conventional wisdom, the things that everybody knew. And that is that God blesses those who are righteous. And God punishes those who are wicked. Everybody knew that when you run into trouble, when calamity comes, when tragedy strikes, there is either some open or secret sin in your life. And so when you come into trouble, the question you ask is, what have I done wrong? Why me? What have I done? Am I wrong? Where have I gone wrong? It was a cruel philosophy or theology, but it was deeply inbred in the human heart then, and it continues to be in large extent even today. I think that's why it's so important to deal with it. The poet of these poems said, I don't believe that. He said, I look about me and I see a mystery of human suffering that cannot be explained. I see the innocent suffer. I see the good coming into calamity. And I see sometimes the careless getting off scot-free. Human experience, what I observe and what I myself experience, simply cannot be put into a neat formula. God blesses the righteous and punishes the wicked. He says, the innocent suffer. I see children die. I see cancer strike willy-nilly. I see fires rage and floods rise. And I see natural calamities, which the insurance companies call acts of God. And I see human calamities when there are broken relationships and betrayals and denials. I see parents who find their daughter raped and mutilated or throat slit. I find young people blown away in war. I see good people, decent people, struck down by any number of things that bring them into intense suffering and pain and loss. And the poet said, it simply is too simplistic. I don't believe it. The innocent suffer. There is a mystery. I can't explain it. Sometimes there is darkness, and there is darkness, and there is darkness, and there is no word to say. Oh, we have words to say. We have pious platitudes, which work for many people. God makes no mistakes. God has a purpose in it. Of course, then you're back in the ancient legend. Then God did it. Or God's agent whom God controls did it. Can't have it both ways. And you tell someone whose life has just been ripped apart with tragedy, you tell them God did it. I don't think we really mean it when we say God has a purpose in it or God makes no mistakes. I don't believe it. The poet Job stood up and said, no, 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 I don't believe it for a moment. He said, I can't explain the mystery of human suffering. I don't know the whys of human tragedy, but I don't believe that God does it. We have something else we resort to, as I mentioned a moment ago. We take upon ourselves feelings of guilt for our failures and for the things that go wrong. Last year, I ripped out of the New York Times this woodcut of William Blake and his woodcuts of Job. And underneath it says, many Americans in the flooded Midwest will sit like Job amid the ruins of their lives and ask why God has turned against them. Nearly one in five Americans told the Gallup poll that the floods are God's judgment on the people of the United States for their sinful ways. And the poet Job says, I won't hear a word of it. No. He was a heretic. He stood up against the received opinion, the common person on the street idea of things, the things that everybody knows. He stood up alone because it was contrary to everything that he felt in his gut. He knew it was wrong. And he dared to say so, and thereby set himself apart. He paid the price, of course. His three friends who came to comfort him, they came, and with delicate sensitivity, when they saw his disaster, they sat with him 7 days and seven nights without opening their mouth. That's a good comforter. Don't say a word. But when Job's voice was raised against heaven, calling God to account, railing against this injustice, this mystery of suffering. Then they ran to the defense of God, or rather to the defense of their belief system about God. And they denounced Job. He was rejected by his friends as well as he felt abandoned by heaven. But he stood up anyway. And he didn't yield. Thank God for that. Thank God that this poem made it into the canon of the Scripture. Because Job gives me permission to think, to experience, and then to seek to connect my experience with my faith. And with faith, explanation doesn't fit with the facts of my life. I keep probing and struggling until I can bring them again into some kind of meaningful relationship. Thank God for this heretic poet. Because as it is, we're told, 1 out of 5 Americans says the floods are the result of God punishing the sin. But think what it would have been if we never had this protest that said, no, 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 I don't believe it. Thank God for Job, who called God into account and said to his friends, I'm innocent and I'm suffering and I don't know why. Thank God for Job, for in his darkness, which was not penetrated by any ray of light, he wrestled with God. He wrestled with God and became a forerunner of another who in his darkness cried out, my God, why? Which is not a question seeking an intellectual answer, but a primal scream of a devastated human being longing to know that there's someone there. And thank God for our confidence that while there is suffering that has no meaning and tragedy that has no explanation, when finally we simply must be silent, that nonetheless we cling to the God of all mercy, who we believe will never let us go. If God plays with us like puppets on a string, you have every right to fear such a God, but you can never love such a God. But if we can trust in the darkness, believing somehow or other in an infrastructure of mercy, that's a God you can love. That's a God you can love when everything goes wrong and nothing makes sense.